However,
we won't go there. They did, and we've got what we've got.
So now what we're going to do is have some of the feedback from the primary financial statements. So if you recall, we effectively had questions around whether there was a conflict between the flexibility that users want versus the requirements of consistency, comparability, and then in terms of alternative profit measures. And what I thought that we would do, and I hope it will work this way, is that we will get each of the groups to report back consecutively, and hopefully my proposal is that we don't have discussion between each one. We get the full report back from each group and then have a more fulsome discussion around whether there are any conflicts in terms of the feedback, and if so, why. But also, in particular, there were a few people that weren't here yesterday for that session, weren't able to be in the breakout, so any comments from them as a result of the four presentations. And I will try to see if it is possible to summarise those four presentations at the end of it. And I'm going to be really Joanna boring, unusual for Joanna, and go groups 1, 2, 3, 4 as the first one. So Jake, ask you, and perhaps just sort of 10 minutes, maximum of 10 to 12 minutes in terms of your presentation, so that we do have some discussion time at the end. All yours, Jake.
Thank you, Joanna. My watch has gone down here. I've made a note of the time, but whether that means I stick to time or not, who knows? This was us in action. Clearly, very handsome man scribing at the front of the session. Probably not a lot more to say to that slide, so maybe if we move on to some of the meat of the session. Thank you for that. I did not put that slide in there. So the questions we had was, is there a conflict between allowing entities the flexibility and providing users with comparable information? We said, no. Is the use of alternative performance measures a problem? We said, no. And at that point, we packed up and went for a drink. Okay, again, when I try and do these jokes, they are funnier in my head than appear around the table. So, having broken the ice, I might try and move on to the meat, as it were. So we presented with this spectrum. I thought it would be actually quite interesting to ask the members of our group both where they sat on this spectrum and what perspective they were answering this question in. So we drew up a little chart. This is very scientific, I should point out, and clearly the best piece of survey feedback the ISB will get on this, as you can see. Did this illustrate anything to us? I was quite interested. I think as you went from the sort of complete flexibility side down to the, we want a detailed chart of accounts, what you actually saw was a pretty consistent pattern with my statistically significant sample of people. So you have preparers and auditors in the more sort of, we need some flexibility, we need to be able to tell the story of the business. And then you move slightly further along and you started to get the standard setters coming in saying, maybe we need some templates, we need a bit more rigor here. Then a little bit further on, you sort of had the investor side getting even more sort of rigorous and need more comparability across organizations. We didn't have any regulators in here, but I'm expecting them to be well off the other end of the scale. No response. Okay, good. I must be right. So that was my highly statistical and significant sample, and clearly very scientific. So we spent a little bit of time talking through these in a bit more detail. So what actually are the issues that we think the ISB might be facing? Well, first and foremost, and the most important one, is our users actually getting the information that they need? Are investors getting the information that they need from the financial statements as they are at the moment? There were some concerns, actually, that data aggregators and some others are actually preparing templates because they don't exist and trying to present information on a comparable basis, but actually that information may be drawn from numbers which aren't truly comparable. So what you are ending up with is fake comparability, to use my phrase. We then had a little bit of a debate about what do we actually mean by templates, and we weren't sure, I don't think, well, I certainly wasn't sure, that as a group we had a real understanding of what was meant by templates. And there was some concerns that the taxonomy will never succeed without some more standardization. How can you have a taxonomy of labels for financial reporting if there isn't some standardization in the background to enable the IXBRL tagging to actually give you consistent information? We had a bit of a discussion about what role the ISB could or should have over MD&A, so management commentary. Clearly, the ISB's focus is very much on the back end of the accounts, but actually where a lot of these alternative performance measures appear is actually in the management commentary, where the ISB doesn't have a formal role as such. And another concern was whether templates would be as responsive to changing business models as they might need to be as business models change. How quickly would those templates become out of date? We had a bit of debate about that. It wasn't 100% clear cut. Moving forward, Ida, there were some general observations. There were some general agreements, which I actually found quite surprising given how sort of spread we were initially. And I'm going to speak for the group here, and I'm glad you told them, Joanna, they can't respond until after everyone's responded, because hopefully they've forgotten what words I've put in their mouth. But broadly, there was no one favouring a complete set of a chart of accounts which was set out so detailed that it was absolutely clear what was admin expenses, what was marketing expenses, what was interest. No one favoured the sort of complete chart of accounts. But there was some general support, actually, for some standardisation of terms that management tend to use to draw attention to figures beyond the normal profit figures that we see in financial statements. So EBIT and EBITDA are very common as a starting point for management commentary and adjusted numbers, APMs, if you want to call them that. So there was actually some fairly broad support, perhaps, for actually defining what those are and defining what went into EBIT and EBITDA. There was again generally broad support for leaving MD&A policing to the regulators. No desire to expand the role of the ISB into management commentary. And there was some general support around having some general templates, maybe with EBIT, EBITDA on there, perhaps being overlaid with some industry-specific disclosures where it was clear that a particular industry regularly used a particular performance metric. I've forgotten whether I have any more slides, Ida, so please surprise. I do, that's good. Thank you for the feedback. So what are the next steps that the ISB need to take? First and foremost, we thought actually defining EBIT and EBITDA would be a good thing to do. What we mean by this is actually what goes in there. So we had a little bit of a discussion about some businesses include some forms of interest and interest expense in EBIT, exclude it, I should say, from EBIT. Others include things like the unwinding of the discount on pension schemes, for example, was a specific example used yesterday. The ISB should work with and support IOSCO to monitor the use of APMs in MD&A. So what do IOSCO, what do the regulators need from the ISB? We should seek to understand that better. And perhaps keep an eye on what other alternative performance measures might be commonplace. What are regularly used, particularly in specific industries, and should the ISB therefore play a role in defining some of those? I'm fairly certain that now completes my slides. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jake. And although I said no comment, if any of Jake's or Group 1 has a fundamental disagreement with what Jake said, please speak now. There you are. You've got support. Let's then go to Group 2. Vincent.
Thanks, Joanna. My group was largely comprised of regulators. We also had some preparers, mainly representing financial institutions, both banking and insurance, and I guess myself representing users. Pretty similar to the other group, there's a sense that functional perspectives do drive the views around the preference on the structure of the financial statements. So some general comments before I get to the specific question. We had some comments around the scope of the changes, and the comments are largely revolving around the statement of performance. There was support, some support for the definition of key subtotals. We also had support for classification of income statement line items, so a distinction between recurring versus non-recurring line items. But that being said, there are different points of view as far as who should be responsible for making that distinction. Because I think currently you do have the securities regulators, such as IOSCO, coming in and sometimes clarifying what's recurring versus non-recurring. And the question then tended to be, should it be under the ISB's remit? There's a question around the positioning of the primary financial statements. So the whole notion of the statement of financial performance, I think someone deemed it to be a bit of a misnomer because you're really focusing on the profit and loss statement. But what's really relevant was that there was some appetite for a more comprehensive approach from some of the members. So a holistic approach, as they described. I think one or two of the members hinted at the necessity of that, in contrast to what seems to be a more targeted approach. Next slide, please. There's some discussion around the evidence that needs to predicate any decisions that are made. Around the scope, the question of P&L versus the comprehensive income, we had the privilege of also having an academic in our group, and she did point out that there's evidence suggesting that certain users can be misled by the structure of financial statements, and there's need to clarify OCI components. And there was also quite some discussion or implied views based on the benefits of enhanced disclosure relative to having enhanced presentation. And on that particular point, there's a sense that sophisticated users are able to reconcile data from primary financial statements. But that being said, there's other evidence which also suggests that presentation is beneficial to users of financial statement. So when you think of value-relevant studies that do exist, but also there have been other types of studies, behavioral studies. I know one of the fellows to the ISB, Ann Tucker, has had some studies which does show disaggregation does actually enhance the interpretation of financial statements. But the key point is really to have some evidence-based approach to determining what suits investors. And there's some way to go to really decipher the different types of investors that do exist and how they use financial statement information. And actually, there have been some interesting work that's been done. I know EFRAG has issued two papers which has looked at the use of financial statements. But papers in that spirit would certainly be helpful. Some high-level views around the primary financial statements that are important. A comment was made around it depending on the industry. So the statement of cash flows was deemed to be less useful for banks. Next slide. On the core question as to the conflict, yes, there's a conflict, and that's largely preference tends to be largely driven by functional roles. And there's an elaboration of how people's views on standardization relative to the flexibility. So there's anticipation of comparability. There's quite some good example provided in the European context where the pre-IFRS world, the IS1 requirements could be looked at relative to what you had in place before. So we've got fixed formats. We had fixed format across industries, and that was deemed to be more informative than having a more flexible approach. I think there are also lessons that can be learned from feedback that you get from investors on segment reporting, because that's one area that preparers have the opportunity to tell their story. And to be honest, all the feedback I tend to hear is that the stories that tend to be told are not good enough for investors. There's a view that you could still tell the story through disclosures. Then standardization would also be aligned with enhanced delivery technologies, XBRL. There'd be benefits of cost. And there's also the angle of possibilities of having enhanced assurance and hence preferring greater reliability of particular subtotals. On the flip side, I think, as was mentioned by the other group, there's the whole notion of false comparability because business models aren't the same. There's heterogeneity across business models. I think there's the acknowledged challenge of there being difficulties in defining subtotals. There seem to be some openness to having some industry-specific type definitions, but I guess that's a bit of a challenge when you think of the general purpose accounting framework. There was also a concern about an increase in disclosures if you've got more standardized approaches. And one point that was raised also was that the loss of flexibility could lead to a bludgeoning or a growth in the MD&A, perhaps representing more non-GAAP measures. Next slide. So that was really the trade-off that was in place. As far as answers as to what needs to be done, I earlier mentioned that this need to really interrogate what users need and to create solutions that appropriately take those into account. But there were other options that were also put on the table. One was around there being guidance that describes the operating profit, but there also being an accompanying accounting policy election. And another idea that I think has got a lot of support across many investors and investor groups was one whereby you'd have an elimination of classification options. And I know the different groups, I know the EFRAG user panel, the CMAC, has indicated that they do support, I'm not sure about the CMAC, but I know the EFRAG user panel has tended to support this particular idea of eliminating classification options. The next question was APMs. Is there a user problem? Here, there's a bit of a glib answer, yes and no. Yes, to the extent that it undermines the comparability of the reporting framework, and I guess there's the whole substitution effect. So are there situations where there's greater reliance being placed on this alternative framework? Not to the extent that they're supplemental measures, but I think it needs to be acknowledged that they're here to stay. We didn't really have a comprehensive elaboration around this in the sense that a lot more time would be needed for that. What does the ISB need to do? There's a sense, from my synthesis of the discussions we had, there's a sense that there needs to be a better understanding of why the ISB needs to be involved in this particular space, rather than really dealing with it at, you know, a very generalized level. So there's need to distinguish types of alternative performance measures and also to have a sense of where there's a primary concern. So is it about particular people veering away from GAAP measures, so for example on revenue? It needs to be a lot more of a fine-grained approach. Then there's also need to understand investors' perspectives on these measures. What types of APMs do they actually use and why do they use them? And what do you learn from how they use them? That's really important. And also from the preparer's standpoint, to understand what's driving, what accounting framework requirements actually driving APMs. A comment was made actually based on the experience in South Africa where we've had headline earnings. And there we've got a very regulated approach towards these measures, and there's the question as to whether this extra layer of mandated requirements results in more useful APMs. And the question also around the location of APMs, press releases versus what's there within the corporate reports and how that affects their usefulness. So there's a sense that what's in the press release is more useful. But again, there's other academic evidence which actually shows you tend to have more retail type investors paying more attention to the press release information. And the more sophisticated players may not be as treating them in such a less sophisticated fashion. But there needs to be some understanding around that. And then finally, there was also the question, which I think the other group covered, the role of the ISB versus the security regulators. So location of APMs would be part of the issue that would be considered. And the question that I mentioned earlier, recurring versus non-recurring classification, whose role is it to make that clarification? Thank you.
Thank you, Vincent. Anybody from Group 2 would like to add anything to that? Okay, group three, Gora. Let me pass this over to you.
Yep. Oops. Thank you, Joanna. That the group three has a well-diversified members from preparers, investors, regulators, and academics. And we had a very lively discussion on this primary financial statement agenda. Next, please. We discussed along with the questions on the agenda paper. And first question is structure. Is there a conflict between flexibility and comparability? And our answer is somewhat different from the Jake's group, but yes, there is. And but the one of our members suggested that the probably that the we should call it, it there is a tension rather than conflict. And the one of the preparer members says that the IASB cannot standardize everything. We should focus on education rather than standardization. On the other hand, investors, in order to, investor member says, in order to achieve the high quality financial reporting standards, comparability has to be enhanced. So that the investors somewhat frustrated that the lack of comparability of the IFRS-based financial statement. And the other preparer pointed out, even for preparers, comparability needs to be enhanced. Computers in the same industry may use different performance measures, and it is difficult to compare performance. But no need to achieve right balance between comparability and flexibility. So that is one of the reasons why we would say rather tension rather than conflict. Next. The next question, how should the ISB address the conflict in the in the project? And the majority of our member support for introducing more subtotals like other groups. We are concerned that if the ISB takes that the too prescriptive approach. And for example, that the industry specific template and one member doubted or concerned if the ISB developed the industry specific template, that might be too much. For example, automotive has manufacturing and finance operations. And also, it was suggested that the strictly defining what is recurring would be too difficult. So this kind of classification between recurring, non-recurring type, you know, discussion could lead to end up with nowhere. And the other comments on this question one includes, investors seems to focus more on EBITDA and other performance measures rather than profit. So like other groups, that we prefer that the definition of EBIT or EBITDA type, you know, the items which everybody can agree upon. And the IAS1 does not provide sufficient guidance. So more guidance would be needed. But if we have too much guidance, that would be too prescriptive. So it should be not too much. And also, we need, some people said that we need this distinction between profit loss and OCI. Actually, I come from Japan, and the Japanese stakeholders love this kind of discussion, but I did not say this anyway. Okay, so next, please. And the Q2. APM, regarding APM is a use of the use of APN problem, and we hear somewhat different views among our members. Preparer says, not sure it is a problem of ISB. Security regulators should police the issue. And on the other hand, regulator says, securities regulators' guidance tend to cover only outside of financial statement. So if performance measures are used in financial statement, standard setters should address it. So that the securities regulators want to limit their responsibility to outside of the financial statement. And from investors' point of view, it is a problem that APM is a problem because it could be abused. And one of the preparer members says, in fact, that more items are classified in non-recurring category these days, and which might be some kind of abuse. And a member of academics from academics says that the academic findings confirm that increase in use of non-recurring items. So it could be a problematic. Next, please. So the final question is, should the ISB do to address the issue of APM? If so, how? And our answer is yes. Standardized subtotal and other performance measures can become anchor for performance measures that entities use. So even with such anchor, APM would not be eliminated. However, comparability would be enhanced. And even if the APM can be used outside the financial statement, that the preparers can suggest how these APMs are presented or disclosed outside the financial statement, they can be reconciled to this anchor. And the IFRS standards currently do not have enough standardized performance measures, and ISB should learn from use of non-IFRS information in practice to enhance the relevance of the financial statement. Okay, I believe. Do we have next? I think this is the last one. Yeah.
Thank you.
And does anybody from the group three can add that comment?
Thank you, Goro. Roxana.
Yes, thank you. So in group number four, we had representatives from the preparers, from the auditors and regulators. Unfortunately, we didn't have anybody from the user side because Anne couldn't join us yesterday. So first point regarding the conflict between flexibility and comparability, I think there is a kind of sense that there is a conflict because certainly the preparers, they would like to go in their direction and have as much flexibility as they wish, while for investors that would be somehow more difficult to compare information. We got some examples that actually there are some industries in which there, before the introduction of the IFRS, for example, there were some kind of templates, but in any case, kind of models of presenting information which are very helpful, and I think that would be actually something which is valid for the APM as well, and that was actually really useful. Certainly, the IFRS were not going in that direction, and there was a strategy of not creating industry-specific, but the sense of the group was that actually that was something which was useful. We didn't put on a chart, actually, who would be more in favor of having a template or having complete flexibility. But I think what we got from there is that actually a template in general serves probably for regulators, but it's for different purposes than would be for the needs of a user. So I think we're somewhere in the middle by saying that a minimum comparability is needed, but also allow some level of flexibility. Acknowledging that also investors, they want comparability, but not full uniformity. Then regarding the still on the same point on the templates, I think the idea was that if regulators would step in that and imposing some templates, that would be that would create a damage, because then we have different templates in different jurisdictions. So we think that the ISB should play a role by probably starting to define some minimum components from the primary financial statements, but acknowledging in the same time that might be difficult, like just defining the operating profit. There are some doubts of how long it will take the ISB to achieve a consensus on such definition. Moving to the second questions on the APMs, I think we consider that the APMs are useful, but there is a potential for abuse, and there are companies clearly abusing, like, for example, presenting some APMs in a more prominent way than the IFRS figures, or not explaining or changing the APMs from one year to another. There are also differences, because there are some APMs which are based on IFRS figures, but there are also APMs which are completely outside the spectrum, like with a very extreme example, a company presenting a kind of operating segment information based on completely different figures than even the operating segments from the financial statements. Then there is a question, I think, of relevance of the financial statements, something which was put by the ISB earlier in the discussion this year. And actually, depending on where the APMs are placed, certainly the investors would look more to probably the press releases or other pieces of information if APMs are not included in the financial statements. And I think based on that, we had a discussion on the scope, whether the ISB should go beyond the financial statements or look only to the APMs in the financial statements. And I think the idea was that at least at this point in time, they could do something on the APMs in the financial statements, starting probably from the ESMA and IOSCO papers, which have some good principles of the use of the APMs on reconciliation, comparability, consistency of use, and so on, which, by the way, are principles which are already embedded in the IFRS standards. So certainly there is some scope for work for the ISB in this area, and at least in order to make sure that abuses are not done. Thank you.
Thank you, Roxana. Some interesting presentations there. And in order to do the usual problem of trying to aggregate too much. So the four groups have aggregated the comments. I'm now going to try and aggregate those even further. How useful that is, I don't know, but there seem to me to be some key themes coming out. And what I've picked up in terms of those in relation to those four lots of feedback was that on conflict, there is, and I'm going to use group three's words, in terms of there is a tension between flexibility and comparability, I think is actually what seemed to come out of each group, that investors are the ones that are looking for more comparability, probably in relation to the groups, perhaps the regulators as well, but investors are concerned, as the major users perhaps of the financial statements, that there isn't enough comparability. There seems to be a consensus that there would be support for more guidance in IS1, more subtotals, so using the EBITDA, EBIT and EBITDA type thing. However, do not make it too prescriptive an approach, I think seemed to be a key message coming through. And in terms of template, I got a feeling that it's sort of, well, possibly, but possibly not, so long as it might work, so long as it's not too prescriptive. But I think Roxana made a very good point from her group that it might be too damn hard to get people to agree what the template would look like. Therefore, that might not be, in terms of a cost benefit, worthwhile pursuing in the near term. One thing that I picked up, which I hadn't really focused on, each group talked about recurring and non-recurring as a consistent issue that seemed to be coming through, which was one that I hadn't properly identified before. So that's what I picked up in terms of the first question. In terms of the second question, in terms of the alternate performance measures, my aggregation is that they are helpful and they're here to stay. that the ISB should probably work more with the regulators in some way around how those work. It's not a core issue for the ISB, but if the things that we talked about in the terms of the conflicts, in terms of the definitions or thinking about EBIT and EBITDA, they would provide a framework or a base on which those alternative performance measures would work. So that would really quite help. And then, and again, the ISB to keep potentially at this stage within the financial statements and keep a watching brief in terms of other alternative performance measures that might start coming up and saying, well, how do we work with those? So that's my, as I say, aggregation of what I heard there. There are two people in particular that I would like to ask to comment from the members. Then perhaps, and I'm not sure what order to do it, to ask for other comments from members and maybe leave the last word to Rachel and Kuchiro in terms of summing up what they've heard and whether they think what I said sums it up or whether it was anything useful. So I'm going to first call on the two I want to call on are Anne and Lota, who were not here yesterday. First of all, to make any comments about what was heard. Anne, would you like to start?
Thanks. Thanks very much. I think this issue about standardized and more flexible format. So we were saying earlier at our breakfast meeting that something I've observed in all of these discussions is that there is creative tension between the demands of investors who are typically not just invested in one company, just to put a not to put too fine a point on it. You know, in our public equities, we invest in 10,000 companies in 47 markets, which is why high quality corporate reporting is so important to us, but also where the issue of comparability is of such value. However, we're increasingly aware that valuable reporting is not just template bound and backwards looking and one point in time. We're grappling with quite complex issues of things that are not easily captured in a template format. You know, I know a new issue and many investors are thinking about this, are the issues of scenarios and the need for looking at scenarios on even new themes like climate change, where underlying principles like materiality are still very important for investors, but the application involves judgment and sensitivity analysis and stress testing and an amount of disaggregation. So the question of striking the balance is extremely important, but I think investors should not be shy about pushing issuers to provide more information and also to keep up the pressure for reporting which gives insight, not just the comfort of a template. And I know that's just at a very high level. And I think also the other thing about the question of the reports is what's happening with companies is moving so quickly often that the official reporting looks out of date almost, you know, once the ink is dry. So I think that we've got to set this discussion into a wider context of the evolving needs of investors for real-time information and for the application of insight and judgment. And the other point I'd sort of repeat from the breakfast is that this information is not used by many long-term owners for the purposes of trading. It's used for the purposes of stewardship and ensuring actually that companies are reporting on their drivers of value, their sources of risk, and that the board, particularly the audit committee, has actually got a grip on what's going on in the business. And I would say, you know, every year that I've been in this world, we've had a series of high-profile collapses, restatements, misstatements, where actually the board is not on top of the information. So one user for this information, obviously the prime user is the investor, but unless boards are getting a flow of information which they can understand, they cannot be good, they cannot be, they're not well informed in terms of their oversight of the business. So I think that the working groups, I agree with Joanna's summary, I do think finding this balance is important, but it's definitely in our case, it's not only but also As somebody who once famously said, the tyranny of the awe. You know, actually, the I mean, we have the same debates, for example, on issues around rules and principles. What should be rule-based? What should? This is a big part of the Regulation SK consultation in the US under the SEC at the moment. But it's understanding the different utility. They can't substitute for each other, and you do need both. So I think that may be a rather prosaic conclusion, but I would say do not be put off by issuers having discomfort with giving reporting which they think is not required by regulators. So actually, it's very important for investors, particularly the long-term owners.
Thanks, Anne. Lothar, do you have any comment from the report backs?
Yeah, thank you. Maybe I'll also say a few words. As you already mentioned, it's a very extremely important subject for users, and that's what I get all the time from analysts and investors. And coming to the first question, yes, comparability is extremely important for users. I mean, in a sense, that's one of the whole reasons why you want to have international guidelines for financial reporting, that you can compare also companies within a country and among countries. So that's extremely important. And then the question, is there a conflict and could the ISB do something about it? I think, yes, definitely ISB has a role here because, to improve comparability on a relatively high level in the primary statements and adding further lines, as was discussed, is a thing. Another thing which I think is supported by the vast majority of users. You would still not define everything in detail, but that's not done anyway. Also, with revenue or the lines which are already regulated in the primary statements would be the same concept, but there are alternative performance measures, which are not alternative, which are always used, and we saw some examples here, like EBITDA and so on. That's just standard. So if it's standard in the use of users and of reporting by preparers, then let's make it included into the standard. And to have a template which has these broad categories, which would still only be 10, 15 lines, which is very little compared to the total output of reporting. That would be helpful. It would be helpful also for two concrete reasons. One is, analysts can always, if they get the information in the notes somewhere, build their own model. They have their own model and adjust the model, but there are investors who are using kind of quant models to sort companies or to even, do much of the investment decision, and they depend on the more top-line numbers, and they get them very often from the third-party data providers like FactSet and Bloomberg, who are actually trying to adjust to some degree in a very, very insufficient way, and everybody's struggling with that. So the ISB could bring this whole thing a big step forward by already defining something a little bit more down the line. And then we come to, and I would even do that, I would be very happy, and I think very many people would be happy if that was also true for the segments, with segment reporting. And if those numbers were then also used, not audited, but that's another point. We're not only looking at the one annual report, I mean the quarterly reporting, the management conferences to analysts and so on. I mean that's where the ongoing data is, that's where the valuation happens. So have some better framework would be very good. And then that comes to the non-GAAP numbers. I mean, and that also relates to relevance of the whole IFRS framework. I mean, you have the IFRS numbers and you have even more non-GAAP numbers. And I mean, what are you doing? You're looking forward to try to assess what is the company going to do in the future and is the value that this company has higher or lower than the actual price. So you're looking to the future and the IFRS numbers are one element, and the more reasonably ISB is affecting all financial numbers, the more relevance it has. And I think this tension can be solved by having, let's say, a template and some top line numbers defined, and then on the APMs, don't try to define them because they're variable, and that's where the flexibility is, where the storytelling comes in. That's very important, but there's some principles which would be very helpful, which is like transparency of how they are calculated, reconciling with the gap numbers, and consistency over time. And some of these issues were already mentioned. And then the use of APMs would be much better. And this whole discussion on recurring numbers, that's very important because companies preparers try to manipulate some. And I think something can be done about that too, because if a certain category of, reported numbers, let's say, is recurring all the time, let's say restructuring costs, then don't allow that to be deducted in some way. And also the management view can come through APMs and doesn't have to come in the standard statements. One could say a lot more, but you know, just there's some comments.
Thank you, Lothar, that's very useful. Before we go back to the team here, are there other comments from around the table in terms of what has been presented, or views as to how I've summarised it, or alternative views, or any other comments? Rudolf.
Yeah, just a couple comments. First, with respect to performance reporting, flexibility versus standardization, a theme I saw up there a number of times was the notion of having an industry-specific point of view. And I think, obviously different industries have different perspectives and need different measures to evaluate. So I think in your summary there, I would add that specific point. I know it's a little bit contradictory to the way we thought in the IFRS context, but still I think that's worth mentioning. The second point I would make with respect to APM, I guess I would just add, a couple of thoughts. First is, I think there's a very strong self-policing element to it. You know, the market is always going to be looking very closely and judging management's credibility with respect to the measures and how they're being applied and whether it's consistent or not. Now, that doesn't help from a short-term perspective, but, I do think there is a self-policing element. And I would also say Lothar's comment with respect to principles, core principles are important. There is some experience out there. There is a rule set that's been set by, one of the national security exchange supervisors, and there's probably some good lessons learned there that could be taken up. Thank you.
Thanks, Rudolf. Any other comments? Andrew.
Yeah, I was just following on from what Rudolf was saying there. I mean, one of the things, I guess, which particularly concerns many people is the fact that APMs are used for management incentives. And I guess that's a key aspect that investors are increasingly focusing on. But I think it's something that we mustn't lose sight of, that these complex management incentive schemes are often driven by APMs. And you see examples where, for instance, you would remove the amortization of the intangibles on the business you've bought, but include the profits from underlying profits from the business you've bought. So that there's a lot of abuses that are potentially can happen there. But I think that's really down to the self-policing thing that Rudolf raises.
So, Andrew, are you saying as a result of that they are used for management incentives, that the ISB should be paying particular attention to them? I mean, or you're just making an observation?
It's more of an observation. And to me, it's something I think most regulators are attuned to. But it's one thing that actually increases the attention in this area to be something more than just looking at the comparability of data.
Any Hans is putting up his hand. Do you want to speak? Yes.
Well, first of all, I thought this was a very useful discussion. I think there is a variety of views, but also a broad consensus. Yes, go in the direction of more formatting, of more standardization, but be careful because don't overdo it. So we have had other discussions which were much more all over the place, so this was very very helpful. I am not so confident about the self-policing of APMs, and it is true that a lot of them are being used for remuneration, and in one of my speeches I gave an example of a big company who, in one of their APMs for remuneration, turned a 6 billion loss into a 6 billion profit. I mean, that was really the extreme, but this happens. And we will not be able to do away with it, but one word that really resonated with me was we need to provide more of an anchor. And we do not do enough of that. And I think Lothar's summary of where we should go really summarized it very well. Don't overdo it. We have a template now, but the template is largely empty. So let's just fill up some lines which are being commonly used around the market. I just have a bit of a hesitation to prescribe, to make a definition of EBITDA, because I think it's such a bad bad measure.
But to be fair, Hans, you may think it's a bad measure. 90% of entities use it.
Yeah, but
so how are you going to get away from that?
It's a terrible... I saw an example of an airline which uses EBITDA as a main performance criterion. A capital-intensive industry, such as airlines. You do away with interest and depreciation.
I would encourage you to think about
anyway,
it came up yesterday when we were discussing, because we were just discussing the statement of financial performance, that the comment about free cash flow is used so
sure.
much. And in some ways, EBITDA is used as so I would encourage you to not go completely
I know.
Away from EBITDA.
Okay, yes. Yes, Professor.
No one's ever called me that before.
No, I see your point. I largely said what I wanted to say. It's obvious that it's going to be extremely difficult, except perhaps some simple things like EBITDA, perhaps, but I think we have to do something about recurring, non-recurring, and I think we can do stuff there. For example, a general principle to the effect that if you want to label something as non-recurring, your experience in the last 5 years must bear that out. In which, in many cases, is not the case. And good cooperation with the securities regulators, who are the main. They truly have the task of policing. We have the task of providing some more discipline. I think we both have a task here, and should work together to. I really think it's important we regain territory on the fantasy world of APMs, because I don't like what's going on. And the more information is available for investors, including non-financial information, the more important it is that our financial statements are truly an anchor for the performance, to judging the performance of a company. So I think... For the relevance of IFRS, it's essential that we do something.
Thank you, Hans. Now, Rachel, with Hans having spoken around what he thinks you should be doing, do you have any comments to add?
I just noticed that Gavin has his...
Sorry, Gavin. I just wanted to, I guess, just say a couple of things. One, I think it's important, you know, Hans used the word fantasy around APMs. Well, I'm not sure that's the right tone to hit, really, because clearly there is a demand for APMs out there by investors. Now, whether or not they're used appropriately, whether or not they have enough discipline about how they're used by preparers, etc., I think that's a very good question. There is a market discipline aspect to it, as Rudolf said, although that is, you know, obviously plays out over a number of reporting periods, etc. But I think APMs do have a legitimate role to play in a reporting framework, and I think anything that the ISB does around that is really important to reflect that. I would come back to your articulation about actually what the ISB should be doing is focusing on, if you like, enhancing that anchor point off which any non-GAAP measure is then driven. The other comment I just wanted to, I mean, it's my view, I really would caution the ISB about going too far down any recurring, non-recurring definition type path, because we've been there multiple times before. There are already in regulation quite strict rules around the use of that label, what they apply to, when you can use it as a label, etc. So I think the right steps, frankly, around the use of that label is very much in the regulatory space as opposed to necessarily a standard setting space. Sorry, Rachel.
Firstly, the good news, Gavin, is that you get to have your first say on recurring, etc., in the principles of disclosure discussion paper, so you don't have to wait too long. Just reflecting on something that Gavin said now, but also something he said in our breakout session yesterday, which resonated with me a little bit. We often talk about alternative performance measures bringing into question the relevance of IFRS financial statements, and that sometimes jars with me a little bit because I think sometimes the alternative performance measures are just flattering pictures that we don't really necessarily agree with. But I think the point that Gavin made yesterday that I've been thinking about is sometimes they probably do show that there's a deficit in the information that we're providing. So, for example, some of these operating profit measures, I think, arguably are driven by the lack of subtotals that we have in a set of IFRS financial statements. So maybe what we need to be doing some work on, and I'm looking at Rachel and hoping she doesn't kick me later, is thinking about some of the common alternative performance measures and trying to drill down to those ones which we think really actually are a relevant piece of information that perhaps we're missing, and trying to distinguish those from the ones that we just think are, you know, flattering and not necessarily what we would think of as being relevant. And maybe we need to make a more granular cut, because not all alternative performance measures are sort of created equal.
Rachel, do you want the last word?
Lothar,
I will come back to you, I promise.
If I may, just a short response to the two preparers who were talking about APMs. I mean, one agreement, APMs will be there, are needed, and, you know, shouldn't be overregulated. Second point, market regulation is okay, or supervision, but it seems a fact that adjusted net income tends to be higher than IFRS GAAP net income over time, and it should be, you know, kind of oscillating around the normal number if it was really true adjustments. And I just, in the Wall Street Journal just a few days ago, the SEC seems to be investigating companies for their use of APMs in a non-correct way. So I think there is, and every analyst would have that same feeling, there is a need for some broad guidelines on APMs. I think that would be very helpful. And recurring, non-occurring, just one last comment. I mean, in Germany years ago, we had an official adjustment for adjusted profits, which, you know, was a guidance on how adjusted profit is calculated. So it's not impossible to, you know, put some structure in that.
Any further comments before I give Rachel the last word? Rachel, it's all yours.
Thank you. I've been really encouraged by the discussions that we've had as part of this this session. The feedback that we've heard from this group, I think, has been, although there are different views expressed, I think it has been broadly consistent with the feedback that we've been getting from the sort of extensive outreach that the team, including Kachira, has been doing on this project. We've been talking to a lot of users of financial statements about the potential improvements we could get to the financial statements. And I think there is a broadly consistent message that we ought to be looking at increasing the comparability to some extent. So the idea that the status quo is absolutely fine, I think most people say, well, no, I think there are things that you can do in this area in terms of increasing comparability. But we've also heard the caution that we've heard from a number of the groups here against getting too much into standardisation. So something like a chart of accounts, which some people had raised, I think there's very little support for that. If we start to look at templates, I think there are some concerns about how we can adapt that to industries, and the idea that we shouldn't get too detailed if we do go down the route of looking at templates. As far as alternative performance measures are concerned, again, I think there's a big encouragement for us to work with regulators in this area and look to ensure that whatever we say about alternative performance measures stacks up with the way that regulators actually look at these measures. I think there is an appetite for us to do some limited work in the area of alternative performance measures, but an understanding that it's probably quite a complex and difficult area for us to work on. But overall, I found the feedback very encouraging. Our plans going forward, in November, we're planning to take a summary of the feedback that we've received from the outreach we've been doing on the primary financial statements project, which will include the summary that we've received from the feedback that we've received here at the Advisory Council, with a view in December to asking the board to make some preliminary decisions on the scoping of the project as to what we should and shouldn't be looking at. Obviously, this is still a research project, so the next step would actually be the issuance of a discussion paper once we've actually decided on the scope of that paper. So it's all very early stages in this project, but I'm very encouraged by the feedback that we're saying we should be doing something in this area.
Thank you, Rachel, and thank you both you and Kuchiro for presenting to us, engaging with us, and really good luck for the future of this project. It obviously is a key project going forward, so well done and thank you. And thank you to all of you for your input into this. I think the breakout session on that was really valuable, and in terms of the feedback, and I say congratulations to each of the leaders for managing to pull it into, well, I'm not sure who pulled the slides together, whether it was the leaders or somebody outside this room or Ada, but well done. Anyway, so what we're now going to do is pass over to Anne, and Anne, I'm not sure whether you can want to do it from there or in fact move up here to talk to the group, because you've got some slides which I think we got to put up. Were you going to use your slides? Yeah. So Anne is going to do, you know, as you recall, the intention was that over time, each of the members, each of us will have a go at presenting to the rest of the group in line with our better communication about what the members themselves are doing, what their role is, how they are having an impact on IFRS, both within their organisations and how they are impacting in terms of the creation of IFRS and the maintenance and consistent application. Anne has given us some slides and an awful lot of reading, which I certainly found very enlightening. And as we alluded to a couple of times yesterday when Anne wasn't here, in particular the revised draft policy that the Council of Institutional Investors is proposing in relation to accounting standards setters. So I think that it would be good to engage around that. But Anne, I pass over to you for presentation, and basically we have half an hour, so
yeah.